Welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel. My name is Arimithius, and this week we're carrying on our look at the Elder Scrolls text, The Monomyth. It's actually the last one in the series. We've finally reached the end of the book, and this week we are looking at the Altmeri creation myth, which, for some reason or other, seems to be picked up by fans as the default, at least in terms of how the entities are talked about and the names that they're given. It's the one that places Lorcan as the trickster, as the one who is doing very, very bad things in creating Mundus, and kind of sets the tone for how Moorish perspectives in general seem to consider Mundus a bad thing for the most part. That said, we don't really have that much in the way of how Bosmer think about Mundus as a whole as such, or how other types of Moor consider Mundus to be. So this is kind of the default version, as it were, both in terms of how the fans think about the world and how elves, apart from the Dunmer, think about creation. Note: this part was known as the High Elven Altmeri creation myth, and it's called the Heart of the World. Anu encompassed and encompasses all things. So that he might know himself, he created Anuiel, his soul and the soul of all things. I just want to pause there and say that this process is the process of subgradients that you'll see some people talking about, and the process of splitting one god from another and creating the next step down, so to speak, in terms of the divine ladder. It's also something that links to the Gnostic idea of emanation, that the godhead will almost by its nature create things that will split off from it, shed off from it, and create the next part of the creational ladder down. This is something that influences a lot of how Elder Scrolls cosmology works. Anuiel, as all souls, was given to self-reflection, and for this he needed to differentiate between his forms, attributes, and intellects. Thus was born Sithis, who was the sum of all the limitations Anuiel would utilise to ponder himself. This is the creation of Sithis, who the elves typically revile. It's the idea of limitation and constraint, which they really don't like. However, as it points out here, you need to split things off in order to think about what different things are, otherwise you've just got a mush of everything and you can't separate things out. Sithis is a necessary component here, and that's possibly something that this myth doesn't recognise in its fullness. At first, the Arabus was turbulent and confusing as Anuiel's ruminations went on without design. Aspects of the Arabus then asked for a schedule to follow or procedures whereby they might enjoy themselves a little longer outside of perfect knowledge. And this harkens back to the Redguard and Argonian creation myths. Both of those texts, if you look at Sutakal the Worldskin and Children of the Root, have this notion of memory, of remembering what's gone before, as one of the essential parts of what's going on while the Etarda are forming. And so you've already got some notion of time before we even get to the time god. There's duration and before that point, which also ties in with the Anuad. And you've also got here the first hint that limitation is a good thing, is a freeing thing. The idea that they might enjoy themselves outside of perfect knowledge. The idea that ignorance is bliss, almost. But you've also got hints here towards greater things within the Elder Scrolls cosmology, that you need to be limited in order to progress, in order to grow, is one of the things that comes through when you talk about concepts like Chim and so on. So that's the first hint that we have of that here. So that he might know himself this way too, Anu created Auriel, the soul of his soul. Auriel bled through the Arabus as a new force called Time. This mirrors the creation of Akatosh in some of the Mannish creation myths quite explicitly, although it does bring up some red flags for me when I think about the text Shazar's Song, which we'll get to at some point in this series, which flags Akatosh as a Moorish deity, so who isn't mentioned here at all. So you've got the notion of Auriel as personified time, and the first example of it, which is a direct link and a direct comparison with Akatosh. With time, various aspects of the Arabis began to understand their natures and limitations. They took names like Magnus or Mara or Zen. One of these, Lorcan, was more of a limit than a nature, so he could never last long anywhere. Now this matches what we've seen in the previous myths as well, that Lorcan has more of Sithis in him. If you look back to the Redguard creation myth in particular, you've got Sep, who has more of the hungry stomach in him. That's exactly what's going on here, that there's more of limit than anything else going on with Lorcan. And elsewhere, Lorcan is described as a barely formed urge, in that he's a lot of nothing and not very much of something, so he's more limit than he is substance. As he entered every aspect of Anuiel, Lorcan would plant an idea that was almost wholly based on limitation. He outlined a plan to create a soul for the Arabis, a place where the aspects of aspect might be allowed to self-reflect. Now this process that's described here, entering into every aspect of Anuiel, is something that we haven't seen anywhere. The idea that Atarda can meld and coexist with one another within themselves is very weird and almost seems to go against what happens in the previous paragraph. It's the idea that Lorcan, if he's a limit almost, could well just have wholly different properties to what's going on. And the idea that there's a place where aspects of aspects might even be allowed to self-reflect, then that means that the Etarda aren't able to self-reflect as they are, that there is no real consciousness for these beings, or no children maybe, without the ability to subgradiate and self-reflect and create things that are smaller than themselves. And there's part of me also that thinks that if we assume that the Falmor aren't trying to collapse the towers and bring about the end of Mundus, which is frankly questionable anyway, but if we assume that to start with, does that make their entire goal futile? If the natural state of the Etarda and the gods that the Falmor want to get back to, maybe, if their natural state is to be a thing that wants to be able to self-reflect and create other stuff, then are we just doomed to repeat the cycle regardless? Although I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but they would have to do some serious tinkering otherwise. You notice that Lorcan is the driver here, and outlining a plan to create a soul for the Arabis is Lorcan's idea. You'd have to remove Lorcan from the scheme of things in order to remove the possibility of Mundus. And the original text that talks about the Falmor wanting to destroy the world doesn't go that far. It's simply the removal of Talos, which, unless you equate the two, which is a possibility, won't actually do the job. He gained many followers. Even Auriel, when told he would become the king of the new world, agreed to help Lorcan. So they created the Mundus, where their own aspects might live and become the Etarda. Now this is another layer that we don't really see anywhere else, that these initial spirits, this Auriel is then having a soul which will become the Etarda, whereas most myths equate Auriel and that level of spirit as the Etarda themselves, although there is a text that only says that the Etarda are only the Etarda once they've died, which is part of the myth of the Arabis, but that's possibly because the myth of the Arabis, the Sijic version of events, is mirroring some stuff that's going on in the Altmeri creation myth here, that this is the first one to mention the Etarda as the dead things, and that's where the Sijics are getting their ideas from, or at least deriving their tales from, with the myth of the Arabis. But this was a trick. As Lorcan knew, this world contained more limitation than not, and was therefore hardly a thing of Anu at all. Mundus was the house of Sithis. I just wanted to flag here that this is a little awkward if you think about the traditional unfolding of the soul stacking and soul subgradients that's present in the Anuad. This is equating Anu and Sithis, whereas the other texts that we have equate Anu and Padme, which is a little strange. There are some texts that say that there's just Anu and his other, which was what was said at the start of the monomyth. But it also seems that if we try and reconcile all this stuff, then we're going to have to skip a level of subgradient somewhere, or at least blend a level of subgradient somewhere. It's not as neat as we'd like it to be, maybe. And I'd also like to point out that with the phrase the House of Sithis, Sithis is referred to as the start of all true houses by Vivek in the 36 Lessons. And the start of all true houses, that's about saying that that's not part of us, or they are not us, we are us. And the ability to differentiate is key here. And any expression of the idea of houses and divide yourself amongst your houses, which occurs in a few texts, is relating to the fundamental division and separation and definition almost that is only possible when Sithis is invoked. As their aspects began to die off, many of the Etard have vanished completely. Some escaped, like Magnus, and that's why there are no limitations to magic. Others, like Ifri, transformed themselves into the Elnafei, the Earth Bones, so that the whole world might not die. Now, this is equating the Elnafei with the Earth Bones themselves. There are some confirmations of this that we see in ESO. When you talk to aspects of Ifri, they will refer to themselves as an Ifri, almost, and equating Ifri with the Earth Bones in itself as a law of nature, as Baladas Demnavani points out in The Elder Scrolls 3 when you speak to him. And so you've got gods laying down their lives in order to make everything stable and make it carry on. Although this doesn't necessarily marry up with the divines, with the eight that we see getting worshipped later, if you think about how it all hangs together. If there are some aspects where it overlaps potentially, but because you've got Akatosh as time and you've got Lorcan as the missing ninth is space. But if you think about what the other eight represent as things like love and commerce and knowledge, they're not fundamental to the laws of physics, so to speak. So the Earth Bones are not really anything to do with the divines as such, or the Aedra, as the Altmer would have us think about it. Some had to marry and make children just to last. Each generation was weaker than the last, and soon there were Aldmer. Darkness caved in. Lorcan made armies out of the weakest souls and named them men, and brought Sithis into every quarter. Now that's what happens with the rest of the souls. The ones that marry, I think, are the ones that become the Aedra, because they're not necessarily the things holding Mundus together and making Mundus function, if we take this account as true. However, we've also got another mystery that's cropped up, that Lorcan making armies out of the weakest souls and naming them men. This is potentially an admission that men and Myr come from the same place, but it's also not, because you've got Lorcan transforming souls here. You've got the souls being taken by Lorcan and making them into something, which is potentially where the difference between the Aldmer and men creeps in. But the difference is not really there. It's only because Lorcan did something to them that they are different, that they are men. They're still derived from the same source, potentially. It feels almost like they were derived from the Aldmer, which is a very, very different and weird perspective if you think about how men think about themselves. There's no account that says that men who do think that they were created are derived from the same set of spirits as the Aldma. Ariel pleaded with Anu to take them back, but he had already filled their places with something else. But his soul was gentler and granted Ariel his bow and shield so that he might save the Aldma from the hordes of men. I just also wanted to flag here that it's a bit weird that Anu has already filled their places with something else. We have no indication of what that something else might be. And unless it's something to do with what Lokhan is doing here. But that's purely speculation on my part. We have no indication of what this something else might be. And it's also yet another parallel with the Yokuden tale that Tor Papa wouldn't let the spirits back to the far shores because no. It also reminds me a bit of Eru and the Valar in the Middle-earth mythology. The idea that nothing can be done to change the music. And once the Ainur have sung it, it's not something that can be changed. That it's that Eru decrees it will be so, and then it will just carry on. There's a line somewhere that says that even Melkor may not alter the music in Eru's despite. So this is all potentially, if we're to think of Anu as a being that has a will, which the elves might, or at least a direction, then be functioning in accordance with Anu's will, if you argue it that way. But his soul was gentler and granted Ariel his bow and shield so that he might save the Aldma from the hordes of men. Some had already fallen, like the Chimer, who listened to Tainted Et Arda, and others like the Bosmer, who had soiled Time's line by taking mannish wives. This is an account of how the different types of Myr came to be, but it's also quite different from both the other accounts that we have of the Chimeri Exodus and the creation of the Bosmer, because it still feels like it's happening in the Dawn era. Time isn't straightened out yet, and this is a different time that these events happen if you look at other accounts. The most reliable account that we have of when the Chimer Exodus happened was in the Middle Mirithic, if I remember my timelines correctly, from places like Beyond the Ages of Man and so on. But that's totally at odds with what's going on in this text here. And the Bosmer, if you listen to some of their myths, they just wanted a different life from the rest of the Aldma, and so just departed for Tamriel to get back to nature. Or they were transformed from something that was pre-Aldma by Ifri. This is yet another take on what the Aldma are, which is essentially accusing them of being half-breeds like the Breton, but potentially with more Murishness in them, rather than more man, as we see with the Bretons. Auriel could not save Altmora, the Elderwood, and it was lost to men. I just want to pause here because that's a little incendiary if you think about where men start. Men, if you listen to their myths, start in At Mora. But it also implies, and is backed up by some text in Varieties of Faith, that the elves were the first rulers of At Mora. And that potentially elves and men coexisted on At Mora for a time at least. They were chased south and east to old Elnafe, and Lokhan was close behind. He shattered that land into many. Now this is really interesting if you think about how the elves think about their homeland, which is old Elnafe or Old Meris. That the elves didn't start in Old Meris. That goes counter to what we hear in the Anuad, where the old Elnafe, who would become the Aldma, just stay in one place and keep themselves to themselves and try and keep up their old traditions and all the rest of it. And that's pretty much the way that we see the Altmer behaving throughout most of Tamriel's history. but from this account, they end up in Old Elnafay as a refuge from the Elnafay Wars, which is a little different. And we've also got here that Lokarn shattered that land into many, which is, again, very different, because Old Elnafay, if you listen to the Anuad's tale, is the one of the fragments of the 12 worlds, and is just deposited into the composite thing that is Mundus. Although that does, in a way, marry up with the Anuad, which says that the Old Elnafay realm became Tamriel, in that this land was split by the Elnafay Wars, by this conflict between Auriel and Lokarn. And that's what makes the world as it is today, which is, roughly speaking, what the Anuad says. Finally, Trinimac, Auriel's greatest knight, knocked Lokarn down in front of his army and reached in with more than hands to take his heart. He was undone. And this is the event where Lokarn's heart gets ripped out and kind of finalizes the creation of Mundus. However, I just want to call back to the Chimer. The Chimer were only really the Chimer once they decided to leave Old Meris, or Somerset, depending on your timelines. And so Trinimac, after trying to stop them leaving, gets transformed into Malakath. But with this account, the Chimer happen before Malakath does, which suggests that either the timing of events here is wrong, or there's something else going on with Trinimac transforming into Malakath. And if you look at the text Morlock Orcfather, Morlock does the transformation himself. He rips his shame out. And I think it's the same thing again with the phrase more than hands by which he does it. So you've got Morlock as doing something self-transformational, for the first time for any Etarda, if you think about it, but rather than having it done to him by Boethia, which is the conventional narrative. The men dragged Lokarn's body away and swore blood vengeance on the heirs of Auriel for all time. And so here we have the perennial conflict between men and Myr, or at least a justification for it. This is potentially, as it's an Altmeri tale, something that the Altmer can use to justify hating men. Because they hate us first, because we killed Lokarn and they swore vengeance on us. That strikes me as more a piece of propaganda than anything else. Not necessarily propaganda, but bias on the Altmer's part about how this war fell out. Although, I do find it a little interesting that Lokarn's body has been taken away at this point. We'll see some stuff about the heart in a second, but quite what happens to the rest of Lokarn's body is something we never really hear about, and something I find kind of interesting, because what did the men do with it? But when Trinimac and Auriel tried to destroy the heart of Lokarn, it laughed at them. It said, "This heart is the heart of the world, for one was made to satisfy the other." And so here we see the fulfillment of what the world is for. The world was made to satisfy Lokarn, to produce something that Lokarn wished for. Precisely what that is, that's something that's fairly hotly debated, but I've got my own opinion in a cast I did on Who is Lokarn some time ago. If you want my views on why the world was created and what it was meant to do, listen to that and get some more detail. But just in brief here, I would say that Lokarn created the world in order to limit others so they could move beyond that limit, with everything that implies for transcendence and so on. So Auriel fastened the thing to an arrow and let it fly long into the sea, where no aspect of the new world may ever find it. And that's a rather optimistic ending to this particular myth, because if you've played The Elder Scrolls 3, you know that it has been found. and that the Dwemer are the ones that can find it and start tinkering with it and doing odd things to it. You've also got this particular passage that talks about the indestructibility of Lokhan's heart, and you see it kind of shrivel up and disappear at the end of The Elder Scrolls 3. So either this text is wrong, that the heart of Lokhan is not able to be destroyed, or something happened to it to make it indestructible then but destructible now. And I think there's hints of that in the text for the Five Songs of King Wulfarth, which talks about making a change to Lokhan's heart, or Lokhan's heart being made solid by the tools that the Dwemer use on it. So there's potentially a transformation that's happened there, which, now I think about it, chimes quite nicely with Azura's epilogue to The Elder Scrolls 3, where she talks about the god's heart being freed. So it's possible that whatever the Dwemer did to the heart was what was broken by the Nerevarine at the end of The Elder Scrolls 3, which is kind of what you're supposed to do. So it feels like it's kind of gone to plan, although what you see in front of you is really not indicative of that, which is kind of interesting. And that's it for the monomyth. I do hope you've enjoyed my somewhat scatterbrained read through all these texts, and I hope that you've got a better perspective now on how these texts talk about the creation of Mundus, how they all fit together to create something of a composite picture of how the world works. This one in particular, I think, has more influence than most in how the fans think about that, how things are put together, or at least the forms of it. There's a lot of acknowledgement in this text, seemingly, that things aren't quite as good as the Ultmer would want them to be. There's hints, looking at this text, that don't really marry up with other accounts of timelines that are generally more trusted. And there's also hints that the Ultmer aren't necessarily getting it right, I don't think. But I do think they're getting it right in terms of the things that are happening, but I don't think they're getting it right in terms of how they're thinking about it on a normative level, shall we say. That they're thinking of these things as bad, as something that shouldn't happen. But the way the text presents them here is a little bit more neutral, and the ideas that are presented is what essentially allows the world to be anyway. And I think, as I said, there are hints that even if the Ultmer do manage to bring the world back into a pre-Mundus state, then they will just simply start the cycle again. And that's it for this week. Next time I will be back to our questions, but in terms of the next text that we're looking at, I still need to decide on it. I was thinking maybe about Shazar's Song, but I've had a few ideas from the Written in Uncertainty Discord server as well. If you have any more suggestions for what you'd like me to read through and go through, then please let me know. I'm thinking, given that it's elsewhere this year in Elder Scrolls Online, that the Khajiiti myth might be a good thing to actually get to, and to contrast with some of the stuff that we're seeing in the newest Elder Scrolls expansion. So we might look at the words of Clan Mother Anisi. But if you have anything else, please let me know. You can get hold of me at writteninuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter @Aramithius, and there is always the Written in Uncertainty Discord server. I'll also be posting all of the notes that I make for these casts up and available for my patrons, if you want to get access to those and ask questions as I'm drafting the material for these episodes, then please become a patron at patreon.com/Aramithius, and you can see all of the notes as I make them there. And that's it for this week. I will see you next time, and until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky and Jeremy Saul. Check out Jan's work at SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and Jeremy's Northerner Diaries is available for purchase and on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Hey!
Hi!
Do you enjoy being optimistic about bad movies?
Or do you enjoy at least trying to figure out where someone worked really hard on a bad movie?
Well, we've got the podcast for you. New to Robots Radio, we represent Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast.
Each week, we look at two movies that did really badly critically, but we try to find the good in them.
And we have segments such as, what could have saved it, and would you watch it again?
If you're there on a Saturday night, you want to watch a bad movie, but you're not sure if it's like good bad, or bad bad, or if you should even bother, give us a listen.
You can find us on Robots Radio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.
Please come and say hi. We love you already.
Goodbye.
Rated M for mature.
Because we don't believe in scripted advertisements, we're gonna do this raw.
I'm regretting this decision.
No, you're not. This is the DL, Weekly Gaming News. There's nothing to regret here, because it's your source for everything in the gaming world. Every week, we bring it to you, unscripted, unfiltered. That's why it's rated M for mature, right, Brenna?
Among many, many other reasons.
I am one of your hosts, Jameson.
And as he already said, I am Brenna, the other glorious part to this quality podcast.
You can find us every week wherever you listen to your podcasts at DL Gaming News. And you can also find us on Instagram and Twitter if you want some gaming news in your social media feed every day at DL Gaming News.
And you can find us individually if you really, really, truly want to see our faces. I am at DL _ Mother Goose.
And I'm at DL Jameson. And this was an advertisement. Go fuck yourselves.
Should introduce myself. I'm Corin Black, a humble half-demon, and folks around Baltimore call me the Devil's Runt. Here we go, finally moving again.
How do you feel about methamphetamines?
You know, devil's blood don't make you a devil.
Under the Shroud, fantasy, noir, and horror from Baltimore's sin-soaked streets. Find creator Ian Humphrey on Twitter at @fictionalian.